supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
As you contemplate a summer evening stroll, gaze aloft and recall that 48 years ago this week, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. Let's recall those heady days with Derek Fitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, you kind of take it for granted at this juncture, this many decades on, but it was a thrilling time.
You're right. It was indeed a thrilling time. It's not just that we were sending humans to the moon, which is exciting enough, but when you think about the technology that was involved and the capability of that technology at the time, it was right at the pinnacle of what could be done mechanically with big machinery and what could be done with computers. And so all of those things put together made it an awfully exciting adventure and one that was clearly understood to be riddled with danger as well.
Is it appropriate to consider that it would be the far easier feat to replicate now?
You know, it would be a far easier feat in some sense, in that computer technology has advanced dramatically, materials have advanced dramatically, our understanding of how rocketry works has advanced dramatically. So all of those things, in a sense, would make it easier to do technologically. But I think the biggest component that's missing today is will. Some people would say that it was terribly expensive, and it was in 1973 dollars. The amount that was said to have been spent on that project was $25.4 billion. If you bring that up to 2005 dollars, the number goes up to $171 billion. But if you look at the program overall, seven missions that were sent to the moon, six that actually landed on the moon, well, you know, that's not so bad for what was accomplished, actually.
And although we could spend the balance of our time substantiating that cost in terms of all the auxiliary benefits that have accrued, not just in astronomy, let's park that for the moment, though. Discoveries are still taking place, including the smallest sun yet detected.
There's a star that's been identified that's just about the size of Saturn, maybe a little bit smaller, but it's 300 times as massive as Saturn is. Now, that sounds like it's a lot, but that's only 8% of the mass of our sun. Now, given that we have those kinds of dimensions, what we find is that this star is right at the lowest limit of possibility for actually having thermonuclear fusion that would allow it to be a star. And it has just enough of a gas component to give it enough mass to actually have a thermonuclear fusion process that then qualifies it as a star.
Was this a former gas giant that became a star, or vice versa, or a different mechanism completely?
Well, the likelihood is that this star is probably formed from a cloud of gas and dust that birthed quite a few stars. And this one is right on the lower limit. It's right on the edge. I mean, you could think of it as the runt of the litter, perhaps. But the evolution of a star like this with so little mass is that it's probably going to live an extraordinarily long time. The stars that live the longest that we've discovered in our galaxy are brown dwarf stars. They're far more numerous than any other stars around, but they're very difficult to detect because they're so cool, they don't radiate very much light at all. You find them off in the infrared section of the spectrum where you can detect their heat signature, but you can't see any light coming from them. So we know that there are many, many, many stars like that. They're very, 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 very small, very low mass, yet they can pull off being a star by generating their own energy.
The size of Saturn, not even our biggest planet, and it's Juno that's observing Jupiter.
Yes, the Juno spacecraft that left Earth in 2011, headed out to look at Jupiter, has been orbiting around the planet for some time now. Every 53 days, it makes a complete orbit. But most recently, just last week, it skimmed down pretty close to the cloud tops of Jupiter, flying over the Great Red Spot at an altitude of 2,200 miles above this gigantic spot. That is its own weather system. It looks like it's a gigantic tornado or hurricane. That would be an Earth analogy, but that gives us an idea of what we're looking at. But using Juno at this distance, we can get much more information that can help us understand more about the dynamics of the atmosphere and this spot in particular. Generally speaking, It's getting smaller, but we don't know why it's getting smaller.
Can't see Jupiter, let alone the red spot when you look overhead, but what is available to be seen in the night sky this week?
So in the pre-dawn sky, looking off to the east, you'll be able to see at around 4:30 in the morning a beautiful thin crescent moon about 5 days away from new phase, not far from the brilliant planet Venus. So if the weather's good, you'll have this beautiful view of these two objects close to each other in the morning sky. If you're there between 4:40 and 4:50, you'll also be able to see International Space Station as it flies across that same view. It rises over in the west-northwestern horizon at about 4:40, and as it's now heading down toward the eastern horizon, it passes directly under the two, Venus and the Moon.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.